Most of us think of them as the stuff of fairy tales and holiday lore. Tiny creatures hammering away on toys and maybe doing a solid for overworked cobblers, or else the ethereal beauties in a Tolkien novel. But there are more than a few people who think elves are not only real, they might be closer than you think. Welcome to Shadowland, everybody.
Welcome.
This is a podcast that shines a spotlight on stories of the supernatural, mysterious, eerie, and unexplained. Stuff like missing 411.
Time travel.
Pervert dolphins.
Interdimensional portals.
Shadow people.
Human-pig hybrids.
Hatman.
Alien abductions.
Michigan dogman.
Alien implants.
Sheep squatch.
Astral projection.
All that stuff.
All that stuff and more.
Lots more. I'm Christina Callery.
And I'm Seth Jablon.
And today, we're doing stories about...
elves.
Elves. Happy holidays, everyone.
That's right. I mean, although, to be fair, like, we've been wanting to do this one for a while, like,
we
in
have.
A very much non-holiday way. Like, although, and I was sort of surprised by it, like, for a number of reasons. I was kind of expecting it to be like...
It's kind of rounding out our trilogy, right? We had gnomes.
Yeah. Gnomes. What, trolls?
Trolls. And
I guess we haven't done elves. I guess there's like still like sprites and...
Fairies.
And all that. Fairies, that would be a good one.
We could do fairies. Yeah.
But I expected this one to be a lot more like... was it the gnomes one where I was surprised by the gnomes where I was like, oh, people actually see, you know, little gnomes with like hats and shit on their time in bubble cars.
Right.
So I kind of like expected that one to be a little bit more like that, but it was more, for me, it was like more like the trolls episode where you're like, have this like amalgamation of like a lot of different mythologies and things. And I don't know. So I don't know what your experience was, but.
Yeah, same.
Yeah.
And it seems like there's crossover.
Yeah,
too, where people might call something a gnome and really it seems like more of an elf or vice versa.
Yeah, totally. And so I think there is something, and we'll get into it. I think there is something about like why we call things by these names, you know? There's something, I don't know. Maybe Joseph Campbell can sort of answer that. but I kind of did like a little bit on the sort of mythology and then I kind of like jumped to something very current and kind of trippy. So
why don't you go first then?
Okay.
You can do the setup.
I'll do the setup, but maybe I'll just go straight into the... Okay, well, we'll see how it plays out.
Okay.
All right. So first off, yeah, like I was just saying, you know, there is a mythology behind the elves. So in Norse mythology, an elf is an elfer or elf. I'm just going to pretend like that's right.
An elfer?
It's A with a little mark over it, L-F-R. And then the Old English is that like A-E character and then L-F. Anyways. But in Norse mythology, it is a kind of demigod. But people say that the origins are actually pre-Christian Norse and Germanic, right? So it's, you know, a lot of this stuff predates Christianity and then sort of, you know, was affected by it in some way or sort of sometimes this type of mythology either like finds its way into the new mythology or it sort of finds its way underground. And this kind of seems like it went sort of both directions.
Well, it's kind of repurposed, right?
Yeah, exactly. Redressed. And so, okay. So in Norse mythology, though, they are described as luminous beings. It seems there's some sort of, you know, some blurring here between spiritual entity and gods, right? Which it's kind of like sort of Native American where there's like less or even Greek, you know, where there's like beings that are like definitely like, you know, three-dimensional, tangible people who walk on the planet. And then there's like this sort of spirits that live in another realm. And then there's something sort of in between, right? And so this is like, I think, one of those categories. So, you know, and it even fits into classes of beings like giants, dwarves, and land spirits. Okay, so like, you know, Greek gods, they can also mate with human beings and create half-human, half-elfin children who look like regular people, but who all also have magical powers.
Oh, cool.
I feel like that's ideal. That's like some fantasy out there.
Have you ever met one of those? Have you met one of those before?
Maybe. Maybe a long night and some ecstasy may have come across. Okay, so also humans can apparently become elves after death.
What?
Yeah, so I guess there was considerable overlap between the worship of human ancestors and the worship of elves. So somehow those are intertwined in Norse mythology.
It's almost like angelic beings in a way then.
Yeah. Angelic, yeah, I think angels is definitely one thing that they're compared to. Angels, like, I guess there's like tiers of angels, right? So there's some, in this case, archangel and all that. And so I think in this case,
like, archangel, I don't know what the other ones
are. That people would have the ability to become an elf after death is interesting. So there are also two types of elves. This time on purpose, I didn't look this up. Dökkelelfr. The dark elves and the Lojolofar.
Okay, your mispronunciations are like becoming legend.
Yeah. and they are the light elves.
Although, we'll just wait till mine.
Right. So there's dark and light elves, basically. And the dark elves live inside the earth, and they have dark complexions. And the light elves live in Elfheimr, which is the land of the elves, or Elfland, and are fairer than the sun to look at.
Where is Elfland? Is it here?
It's like around.
Okay.
Yeah, it wasn't like super clear if it was like this elevated plane, but I don't know if like you can like walk to Elfland or if you have to take a UFO or anything. Like, I don't know.
A portal.
Through
Antarctica.
Yeah. So, okay. So that was just an overview of Norse mythology. Like, I'm not obviously going like very deep there, but I also wanted to talk a little bit about Icelandic mythology. So, in Iceland, the elves are called Huldufólk, or hidden people. They live in enchanted rocks and cliffs where they lead lives that are very similar to humans. They do things like keep livestock, cut hay, row fishing boats, pick berries. They even go to church on Sundays, apparently.
Really? Do they have social media?
Probably some elf version of it. Maybe they leave messages on rocks or whatever. But basically, they prefer to be left alone. And they're also known to be extremely protective of their homes, and they'll cause great harm to those who disturb them. So, in fact, countless episodes that that reflect their sort of territorial nature have been thoroughly documented in Iceland. And in fact, building projects have been altered to avoid causing damage to, rocks and cliffs and things like that, that people believe that the elves have made their home in, right? And like I said, they tend to be like these like rock formations and cliffs, and people even make little, house fronts on some of these places to indicate where they are. Okay, so one of the more recent incidents of this kind occurred in 2015 when a new road was supposed to be laid through an enchanted spot in the lava field of Gahagarun. After many failed attempts where heavy machinery continually broke down for no apparent reason, and numerous workers had freak accidents, they finally were the construction company was forced to actually move the road so that it would go around the elf community and not not disturb them. So apparently this is like a thing that goes down, is they like to work around the elves because they're known to sort of chase off construction crews and make life difficult for people who are disturbing them. And then I think I even read at one point, I didn't go into it, but apparently there's some woman who's sort of become the intermediary. I think she works at some sort of park where there's some of these elf formations, and she is known to sort of talk and sort of translate for them. So she said she can see them and so on. So,
mm-hmm.
So it's definitely like part of the sort of Norse, mythology that sort of entered in obviously into Iceland, but then it's kind of taken on a life of its own over there. So that's kind of like the background of the whole thing. And so, you know, I know you found some different stuff here, but you know, I was looking around, I was like kind of expecting more like the like gnomes where it's like, yeah, definitely here's an elf, he's like got a hat on and shit. And I mean, you may
lives
have
in a treehouse, he makes
cookies. Yeah, totally. Like, I just thought that was going to be a thing. And so I found, like I said, a lot more like the troll episode where, you know, it's just different different phenomena, different you know, places in mythology, and the way that it like reemerges in the sort of collective psyche of an age is very interesting. And so one example of that is Terence McKenna's Machine Elves. Okay.
Oh, cool.
So
I've always wondered what these were.
Oh, really? From the opening, when I would say it in the opening?
Just hearing the term. I didn't know.
You've heard it around places, yeah. So it is a more modern term, just in terms of like, you know, in comparison to, you know, some of the older stuff we're talking about here. But I'm not sure if you know who Terence McKenna is, but
I don't.
You know, okay. So he was a scientist and mystic who was a prominent advocate for psychedelic plants. He was also an ethnobotanist. I guess ethnobotany is the study of plants and their uses through traditional knowledge of local people. And these are uses for things like medicine, food, clothing, and most notably for McKenna, intoxicants. So McKenna is sometimes called the Timothy Leary of the 90s. He's known for his book, this is how I came to know him, The Food of the Gods, which among other things, in the book, he makes a case for the role of psilocybin mushrooms, basically as the, you know, as he would put it, the catalyst for language and brain development for the early Homo sapiens. So his belief is that, you know, as our ancestors began to follow herds around the African plains, they began to consume all the hallucinogenic mushrooms that grew on their dung that they left behind. So, I mean, you know, it's an interesting thought experiment to imagine these early humans, you know, who haven't, you know, developed yet what we call language. And they're sort of like, you know, it is probable, or at least possible, that they were, you know, eating mushrooms and having, you know, profoundly insightful universal experiences. And, you know, what the role of something like that would do to their developing minds. It's a very interesting thought.
Hmm.
And he has also, like, a lot more to say about, like, you know, the role of hallucinogens in society and what's been lost as we've sort of moved away from those types of experiences into, you know, monotheism and alcohol in the sort of modern world, what he calls the dominator society. So it's actually a great book. I highly recommend it. But yeah, one of the central points is this relationship we have with hallucinogens and how they've sort of helped bring us along. So he was also very candid about his many experiences on DMT. So for those who don't know, DMT is short for dimethyltryptamine. Dimethyltryptamine. I think that was...
That sounds right.
I think that was actually close. Which is a chemical substance which occurs in, I think, many to almost all plants and animals, including human beings. It's actually in our brain already. According to Wikipedia, it is a derivative and structural analog of tryptamine, which is a kind of neurotransmitter. It is used as ritually as an entheogen, often for visionary purposes. So, for instance, the now very famous sort of ayahuasca is a version of DMT that has been brewed and browned with other molecules during that process that slows down its properties. And they do that because DMT is largely considered to be the most powerful hallucinogen known to man. There's a very particular kind. I think it's comes on a toad or something that's like the most potent, but DMT in general.
the toads that you have to lick or something?
I don't think you lick them. I think they like smoke them or something. I can't remember, but it's DMT, MEO5 or something like that, DMT, but it's a particular molecule of DMT. So it's also called the spirit molecule because many believe it allows for communication between any living being in the universe, be it plant, animal, human being, and beyond, even in other dimensions. It is such a powerful experience that many people leave their bodies and enter into realms beyond their imagination, or even, you know, some claim, completely other dimensions. And one common experience is encounters with external entities or, sort of interdimensional beings from another world of some kind. And there's a pantheon of these beings, right? And they range from angels to aliens, Hindu gods, gnomes, imps, and even elves. So Terence McKenna first coined the term machine elf, also fractal elves or self-transforming machine elves, after an experience he had with DMT in 1965. And he said, and this is in his words, "I encounter self-transforming machine elves, which are creatures, entities perhaps, and they're not made out of matter." McKenna, he said this actually in a recorded interview. I listened to it. It's actually, I think, on YouTube. They're made out of, as nearly as I can figure it out, syntax driving light. And by syntax, he means language.
Quote, language driving light?
Language in the form of light, I think, is how he describes it. So he calls it.
Interesting.
That's interesting. Yeah, it is.
It kind of like goes back to, you know, in the book of Genesis with the, you know, alleged creation of the universe with let there be light spoken.
Right. And then there was the word or something like, right? Isn't that how it goes? Something like that. That
is in the beginning was the word. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, like he describes it as a language that you can see. So it is made out of sound. It is sound, but you see it. And so the entire, and this is his words, the entire point of the encounter from their perspective, that is the elves, is to teach you how to do this. So he further in this interview, he further paraphrases Jung. I wasn't able to find this exact quote, but it does sound something Jung would say. He said that autonomous elements can escape from the psyche's control and present themselves as independent entities. So like I said, I couldn't find...
That sounds kind of terrifying. Yeah.
Well, I feel like this is something we've like talked about on the show,
for
right?
Sure.
Like, and like it reminds me of like, you know, the Bardo plane, you know, in Tibetan Buddhism, like, you know, that you sort of walk through this world in which, you know, each of these sort of terrifying deities that you meet are actually just manifestations of yourself. They're just masks of your true self. And so, you know, as people encounter, you know, entities in the, you know, in their sort of, you know, whatever spiritual experiences they are, whether they're mystical or you know, through something like DMT or whatever, or maybe literally meet them, you know, on the road, you know, like, you know, I'm not sure sometimes how important it is to distinguish between, right, like, oh, is this, are we talking about this thing that like gets in a spaceship and flies away, or is it this thing that's somehow a manifestation of the psyche that I'm meant to learn from? Like, I think it's, I don't know, in some cases better to see what you have to learn and why we have these experiences. Okay, so either way, McKenna is certainly not the only person who has encountered entities. Researcher Dr. Rick Strassman reported early on in some of his now famous studies about the sort of diversity of the DMT experience. About his research, Strassman says, not that many people in our study saw elves, but many saw beings possessing other shapes and forms. And I remember a story from, I heard on a podcast, one guy had a experience and he was kind of a skeptic, but he did apparently DMT a lot. But he thought it was just like the stuff he saw was just pure hallucination. And he had this experience where he kept going to this place where he would meet this, I think she was purple, this sort of purple woman who was like, I think she had like multiple arms or there was something about her that was very sort of like Hindu godlike. And he kept, and every time he would go there and see her, she, you know, welcome him back and say hi to him and, you know, talk to him. And I guess he hadn't done it for a while. And then one of his friends had a DMT experience, came back and said, told him that he had met this purple woman and she had told him to say hi. So that kind of like, he was like, I don't really understand how that's possible, because he definitely is one of the believers that like, it's all just...
That's fascinating, though. I mean, I guess you could explain it multiple ways, you know? Even if you wanted to hang on to your skeptical hat, you could be there was some kind of, like, ESP transmission of things.
Yeah, exactly. Like, subtle cues, Yeah, so
I don't know what kind of like purple lady with multiple arms, subtle cues. those would be, but that's true.
It was a very specific, like there's more specifics about it.
But I
guess that like still other people have seen this. So there's definitely entities that people come across that are that you know other people see in addition to the sort of usual suspects, like people see gray aliens.
Isn't it fantasy? I mean, when we did the episode about shadow people and we covered Hat Man, for instance, I was shocked to see how many people out there in comments sections had actually seen this exact, and I still come across them. And they don't know. They haven't heard it. So it's not like they're being exposed to some urban legend and reporting back, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's impossible to sort of separate these things at this point in human history. Like, you know, do we have these myths because these things, you know, like I imagine Jung would sort of get at, like, are these like archetypal symbols in our minds that we just can't get away from, right? Like they're built into us. Into our brains, and so we cannot help but see them in the outside world.
That's interesting. And also, like, do they change over time, you know, with technology and you know with
our
culture evolves to our, you know, subconscious visions or whatever you want to call it evolve along with it?
There's this I forget who the guy was,
or are they real?
Yeah, or are they real? Like, do we have these? Do we have this mythology because we have come into contact with these things? Right? Like, it's impossible to say, but we certainly can assume that they're interlinked, right? Like, where the cause is, whether it even really matters, you know, who knows? But you know, we can definitely say there's some sort of correspondence. And just, you know, taking, you know, the idea of, you know, the invisible world as a sort of origin point, we can at least assume that in some way these things have their origin in another world. And whether that's like the invisible world of ideas, you know, as Emerson would put it, right? Like everything starts as an idea, right? In the world of ideas. You know, whether that's
love a sort Emerson. Of psychological.
Yeah, he's the best. But cool. So, all right. So where was I? I kind of lost my place here. All right. So further studies by Jennifer Like reveal that a small group did encounter these elves, but they didn't look like elves at all, which I think is also interesting, right? Like that people use that word elf but then they don't look like elves. Like the gnomes, it's like, yeah, okay, people saw a little gnome just sort of despite themselves. Like who want, like people are just like, who's going around thinking about gnomes with little hats on? You know, but these people are seeing entities and are feeling compelled to call them elves. Okay, so researcher Alan Davis analyzed survey data from a total of 2,500 different DMT consumers about their best experiences while on the hallucinogen. So in this study, only 10 to 16% of respondents used terms like angel or elf to describe DMT entities. Instead, you know, most people use the words like being or guide. You know, that was much far more common. But I do think it's interesting that, you know, even that there was a, you know, a particular group of people that just, that was the word. Okay, so it is a smaller group, but it is a definite one. And I just wonder, like, what is it about this term elf, you know, that, you know, that is conjured at all, especially if it doesn't even look like one, right? Like, what is it about, like, what we think elves are that makes us see or assume this thing is this type of entity? So for some people, they've actually only even just described them as a voice or a presence. So I just wonder what's actually going on here. So I did find an interview in the this magazine called Double Blind, which is a source for all this type of information, where they did an interview with a man who used the name Ali to protect his identity, and he recounts some of his experiences with these entities. Okay, so the experience for him began as usual, a kaleidoscope of shapes and colors, right, that gives way to the scene of the very room he was in. You know, so only some of the things in the room were not quite right. They were sort of distorted somehow, and there was like things weren't quite finished, right? And there was something there in the room with him too. So he describes five silvery beings towering with slender bodies and what he called, quote, alien skin, but their faces were not alien. They were those of his friends. So yet these beings were not his friends. He experienced them as distinctly different, right? And I guess these were like a group of friends that had been in the room shortly before he went into this, but had, I think, were not there at that point.
So it's like these entities took on his friends' identities in a way, or at least the faces?
Yeah, at least the face, right? So he said their faces weren't quite
right. You gotta wonder what the real face looks like.
Yeah, right. Like, what were they hiding? What were they trying to make more palatable?
Or less terrifying.
I mean, it does remind me of, what was that? Was it Contact or whatever? What was that movie? Was it Contact? The one where, like, at the end, like, you're, like, waiting for the alien, and then it, like, he shows up, and it's like, oh, it looks like his father or something like that, or her father. You know, remember the movie I'm talking about?
I don't remember the ending.
It was very disappointing.
Yeah. That's probably why I forgot.
Yeah, because it's like you're waiting the whole, like, it's about contact with the alien. You're just like waiting the whole time, like, show me the alien. It's just like another person. It's kind of bullshit. Yeah. Okay, but the idea in the film was that, like, oh, I'm going to use a familiar face for you so you're not scared. That was basically the idea. Anyways, these people's faces were not quite right. They were kind of awkward and jumbled, and he said leaking light. So there was like light leaking out of their faces. And he had the definite feeling that not only were these entities not his friends, but also they were from an altogether different world. So, you know, these experiences, they often start with this sort of barrage of visuals and sensations, you know, particular sense of traveling through space and time. And if they were slowed down, or if there wasn't such an overabundance of sights, it might be terrifying, right? It's so sensory overload when it comes on. But so in Ali's words, it was such sensory overload. It was so dense that even if I described it, it doesn't really give any indication of what the experience was actually like, says Ali. It felt like time was completely arbitrary. Kind of scary, maybe like you could live a year in there. So, you know, many people will also feel, in addition to all this, the presence of, or they may even have a detailed encounter with, some kind of being. And one that they often feel is from the spiritual realm or even another dimension. In Terence McKenna's case, and many others, it was machine elves. In Ali's case, perhaps it was the very same thing. So,
where does the machine part come in?
I think he calls them, well, I'm going to read another part here about some more description of what they do, but I think he says they're like self-transforming. So I kind of picture them as like literally like, not like gears and stuff, but like almost like there's a mechanical quality to them, right? And that they're like changing, like the bodies are changing. No, like, I don't know, like they're like, there's a mechanism, like a geometric mechanism to them. So let me read you this. Let me see if this adds any color to it or just makes it even weirder. So this is in Ali's word. They were speaking and words were coming out of their mouths, just floating along, he says. Instead, this mysterious speech drifted out, rainbow glowing vapors constructed out of indiscernible rune-like language. It was like captions coming out of their mouths, very cartoon-like, he adds. I felt totally focused on it, like I was going to understand it, but I'm not sure if I ever did. But what he did understand was this sort of deep-seated feeling of tranquility that presided over him during the intense visuals. He said he felt like he was meditating and that it was like very intuitive. So some of the other descriptions I've heard is that they don't want people to sort of be fascinated by them. They want them to like watch them do this thing, which is sort of materializing like language or sounds into these symbols, like basically in the air. And so there's something sort of mechanical about the whole thing. I don't know, you know, exactly why he, you know, he calls himself transforming too. So I think there's like constantly shifting, but the idea is that they're trying to communicate here. And this is from Strassman. The function of the beings is to communicate, and what they communicate is information. Their shape or form may contain that information, but more importantly, there is an exchange, a relationship between the observer and the beings, sometimes verbal, sometimes nonverbal. Then it's up to our mind, our intellect, to decipher the communication and extract the meaning from it. Or, as Terence McKenna put it, quote, an invisible syntactical intelligence giving language lessons in hyperspace. That's what he calls this place. And so just back to this like idea of like, you know, we've talked on this show about, you know, we see what we, you know, in Buddhism, like, you know, it's described as like what we see is sort of like an active hallucination, you know, like around us. What we perceive as reality is really part of our own mental construct. And now in the sort of, you know, scientific world, we're starting to, in the sort of physics and world, we're starting to see that there's a literal truth to this, right? So in 2016, a review published in Brain's Research Bulletin by author Teresa Carbonaro and Michael Gatch wrote, quote, waking reality is created in a similar way to altered states, except that the normal state correlates with events in the physical world. Thus, waking reality can be thought of as a tightly regulated psychedelic experience, and altered states arise when this regulation is loosened in some fashion. I thought that was very interesting. So, yeah, that was Terence McKenna and the self-transforming machine.
Blew my mind, Seth. You blew my mind.
Good. I think that's the point of these machine elves, is to blow people's minds.
Yeah. Very cool. It's really interesting. So, and it's interesting how there's crossover, you know, talking about Jung and
sort of
spiritual concepts and so forth.
Yeah, there's definitely a psychological quality. And I think it's, you know, common in, you know, these types of psychedelic experiences, that they're also psychological experiences, right? People are experiencing their psychology in a very sort of sometimes direct, sometimes abstract way, but it's a very heightened experience, and you're sort of very aware of your own psychological relationship to what you're sort of seeing and experiencing. So, yeah, ooh, pretty cool. Like, I didn't actually know all this stuff. Like, I definitely, like, you know, read Fruit of the Gods and was, like, into Terrence McKenna, but I had just sort of heard about the machine elves in a very cursory way and hadn't really gone into, like, the sort of literal stories behind them, but it's very interesting, right?
Yeah, it's super interesting.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Okay. Well, do you want to do yours?
Yeah. So I basically have a multiple elf stories that are supposedly real.
Yes.
You know? Yes. And I'm going to start in Iceland because, as you said, Iceland has a big elf culture.
Yes.
You know, they kind of own elves in a way right now. There's actually an elf school in Reykjavik. I don't know if you know that.
Oh, wait. I think I maybe came across that. No, but I don't know.
Okay,
really know.
Yeah. But I guess it's mostly like a class for tourists. But I like to imagine that it's, you know, for actual elves, like in the movie Elf, with tiny little desks and little chalkboard. And
are you learning about elf culture? Or
you're
learning
about
elves.
Become
an elf.
I think. Okay. Oh, that would be amazing. No, you're learning, I think, about elves. Elf culture. And the classes are taught by Icelandic anthropologist Magnus Skarphedinsson. He's collected scores of alleged eyewitness accounts, and he apparently believes they exist. So, you know, kind of like what you were saying, like there are numerous ideas about what elves actually are, you know, and they kind of, you know, go from like little physical beings to, you know, gods or spiritual beings. They're thought to be smaller than people, usually, that live outdoors, as you said, and like, you know, the sides of rocks and cliffs and hillsides and so forth. But it seems like in Iceland, the most agreed upon idea is that they're more like spiritual presences. So in a 2005 New York Times article, Terry Gunnell, head of the folkloristic department at the University of Iceland, explained it this way, quote, "It's not like they think there are little people living in there who come and dance outside. It's more a sense that there are other powers, other forces around them." And this is like referring to the people of Iceland who believe in elves. So it's kind of like, you know, like a spiritual, it's not unlike Native American, you know, outlook, you know, with some tribes toward, you know, spirit living in the land.
Yeah. I think the land spirit sort of came up in mind. And like those words like kind of resonate with me because I feel like I've like felt like land spirits. I feel like it's a real thing or something.
Yeah, I feel like if you go to wildernesses, there's spiritual energy.
We've talked about this.
Yeah, the Pacific Northwest, I really felt it extremely intensely.
Right, and whether they're literal creatures or, Pacific Northwest, like you can't walk through those forests and not feel some like energetic intelligence, right?
Yeah.
Something in there that's like, going to work every day or night or whatever, whenever they come out and do their whatever they do. Like, I don't know. Sorry, go on. But maybe we should do an episode on on land spirits.
We totally should. I mean, there were so many different rabbit holes I could have gone down when I was researching these, but I just wanted to keep it a little more strictly.
Yeah.
You know, elf.
Elf related.
Elf related, yeah. Okay, so, as you said, elves still hold a lot of sway in Iceland, and they even derail construction efforts. I have some stories about that as well.
Oh, okay, great.
So, like, for instance, in the 1970s, in the town of Kópavogur, part of the aptly named Elf Hill Road was narrowed from two lanes down to one after multiple equipment failures during the construction. So there was a large rock in the way, and road workers were attempting to blast through it, but their equipment kept faltering, and breaking down, and finally people came to believe that the rock was inhabited by elves and basically just decided to leave it alone.
Wow.
And then in that same town in 1996, so, you know, over 20 years later, a bulldozer operator named Jorter Jardersen was attempting to raise an area to clear it for the creation of a graveyard. And they had to bring in two different bulldozers because the machines repeatedly broke down without any explanation. They couldn't figure out what was wrong with them. Local TV crews descended on the area and they tried to film there, and their cameras malfunctioned. So even though they were able to capture footage in the surrounding areas, they couldn't when they went to this location. So there was something going on in this area, energetically, perhaps. And so finally, officials decided negotiation needed to happen, and they called in a resident elf communicator, which you've touched on. Dude, yes. Or maybe there was more than one. But this is the thing.
This is like a job.
Yeah, it's like a vocation. You know, people have a gift and they can communicate with elves. And apparently they can be hired. So these communicators were able to reach an agreement with the entity so that the project could be finished.
Awesome.
Yeah. And the bulldozer operator was quoted as saying, quote, "In my opinion, well, whatever it is, hidden people or elves, it has just accepted this and moved away from there." So then, in 2012, Icelander Arne Johnson had a 30-ton boulder moved from a place called Sandskeed to his home in Hofbol. And the reason for this Herculean effort was that supposedly three generations of elves lived inside the boulder, an old couple on the upper level and a young couple with children in the lower level. And Johnson discovered this in 2010 when he survived a car accident near the boulder against all odds and thought these elves had saved his life.
Oh, wow. Interesting. I like how specific he's like, okay, this one's name is...
I know. I kind of want to know about the decor.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. What is like an elf? Oh, dude.
Oh, man. So cool. Wouldn't that be so cool?
I bet it's like super cozy inside.
Yeah, I bet it's really cozy. It's like one of those like when you were a kid and you'd read like stories about little chipmunks that had, you know, their little acorn bowls and little beds made out of, I don't know.
I'm sure you saw pictures of like the little like house fronts that people build like for the in like,
the doorways, the little doorways.
All right, sorry, go on.
Okay, so now I'm just gonna dive right into some eyewitness encounters.
I'm ready for it.
Okay, so this one came from a comment section. My great grandfather told me and my family that one time he got lost while hunting alone. He used to make trails to find his way back, but something had happened to his trail. Someone or something had wrecked it, or the rain washed it away. Can't remember that part of the story. And it was he was lost for 5 days. On the fourth day lost, he was sleeping in a small cave-ish thing when all the little people helped him by feeding him, getting him warm, and showing him which way to go. They helped him find his way. If not for them, he probably wouldn't be alive for as long as he was. He passed away when I was about 11 or 12 years old. I do not care if people believe me or him, as I know he was telling the truth, because where I'm from, there are quite a bit of sightings from these little people throughout the years.
Oh, wow. Where was there any indication?
I don't know. I couldn't tell. It didn't say. Okay, so there's another one. I'm Native American, and I know the little people exist. Some are taught it's a story to scare children, but those of us who spend enough time in the woods and those of us who choose a spiritual path know better. They are like spirits, but not the same. Live here with us, but can show themselves when they want to, like a ghost, but they're alive like us. So Here you have the thing where you're talking about, you know, the spectrum. This is kind of merging both, you know, the physical with the spiritual. They can be good or bad from one moment to the next. In this way, they are considered tricksters. They are very private and prideful. It is best to avoid them. It does not pay to cross them. It sometimes pays to do them a kindness. They are known as, quote, the finders. If you honor them and their space of dwelling and leave them offerings of tobacco with something silver when you lose something, it may take a bit of time, but they can often bring it back to you. Anything lost, even good things in yourself you wish you had back. Be careful what you ask when you put down tobacco. You will get what you ask. It may not come the way you want. Praying selfishly or out of vengeance can cost you your life or your good self, your heart. So be careful. And I saw this in more than one place when I was reading different accounts of Native American experiences with little people. This leaving out tobacco as a gift. Okay, so this next one, this next person says, I live in Dallas, Texas, and I live at some nice apartments, or I lived at some nice apartments a couple years ago. I went to hang stuff up in the storage space, and I accidentally knocked one out of the wall. He fell screaming, ah! It actually says that. Thump. Got up, looked at me, and I was in disbelief. He ran under the wall. I saw his feet till I saw him pull up and he left. But he had on green-brown rag clothes. I never forgot.
Rag clothes?
Yeah, it sounded to me kind of like Robin Hood, Peter Pan, kind of elf style.
Okay, okay. So it was like just chilling in the wall and it's rag clothes.
Yeah, but you know what? When I was I was researching the gnome stories, there were some gnome stories where they came out of walls.
Really?
Yeah.
That's creepy. I don't know if I'd want
little people. A lot of times it was like gnomes. Kids, you know, who would see something, you know, they're lying in bed at night and there's some like little tiny people that come out and dance or play around or drive around in a little car or something like that. I've heard those stories.
Awesome.
Okay, so this one is from a user, Alpha4, that was on forum.tzuk. And they said, I was driving back home late one summer's night sometime in the 80s. I had been out drinking with a group of friends, but I was the designated driver that night. We took it in turns to drive. So I had not touched a drop of alcohol all night. I dropped the last mate off at his home and was driving down a country road. I knew the road well and must have driven down there 1,000 times, still do. It was pitch dark, middle of nowhere, early hours of the morning with no other traffic, so headlights were on full beam. As I rounded a gentleish bend, this small figure was about to step into the road. I could clearly see it in the headlights as its head snapped round with a surprised look in my direction. As I passed it, the figure stepped smartly backward up against a roadside oak tree and stood upright and rigid in an attempt to blend in with the tree. Needless to say, I was as surprised as the elf, and without thinking, I jammed the anchors, screeched to a stop, put the car in reverse, juddered back down the road, jumped out of the car and sprinted over to the oak tree. And nothing. Of course, the elf was long gone by this time. I called out hello a few times, but to no avail. Eventually, after searching the undergrowth a bit, I got back in the car and continued home. I believe I have a vivid memory of it to this day, and I'll describe the figure. About 3.5 to 4 feet tall, not a child, proportioned like an adult, slim and delicate looking, graceful, I believe is the word, dressed head to toe in beige. And then they say, yes, beige, exclamation point, like it's including some type of hat. So this is completely different, but you know, the person that just said the green brown rag clothes.
Maybe they like drab fashion.
Yeah, and then they end it by saying, so there you have it. I am thoroughly convinced and believe I saw an elf.
Nice.
Okay, so this one was shared on a forum online by a woman going by KT, who said, in October 2003, in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, I was out playing on our patio with my 2.5-year-old son when he stopped suddenly and asked me, who was the little man sitting on our stone wall? I looked where he was pointing and saw nothing. But the area looked different somehow. Shimmery? Later, in January 2004, we were again outside playing, this time with my husband, when the most beautiful snow began to fall. It was just coming on to dusk, and I said I wanted to take a quick walk in the woods, and my husband would watch our son while I went. I started through the woods and was somewhat perplexed by how different everything looked. Hard to describe. Again, shimmery is the first word that comes to mind. As I rounded a bend in the path, I came face to face, about 3 or 4 feet away, with a little elf-looking man peering right at me from behind a tree. It was almost a stereotypical elf, long, pointy ears, long, funny-shaped nose, very long fingers, and pointy cap. It was wearing red clothes and hat, and its skin appeared to be a very light lavender color. I let out a startled, oh, and it jerked back and just disappeared into thin air.
Wow, that's great. I love the, like, classic elf look.
I don't know, it's like, it's classic elf, but like it's kind of got, like, it stole, like, that... the pointy red hat from the gnomes.
Yeah, yeah. Lavender skin. What was it? What would that look like?
Lavender skin. Lavender. Yeah, lavender skin. Yeah.
Like a pinkish purple sort of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like kind of almost like with a little hint of gray in there somewhere, mm-hmm. which makes you kind of think of aliens, but.
Yep.
Okay, I've got a few more.
Okay.
All right. So these next few were supposedly shared on a paranormal phenomenon forum and have made the internet rounds. And I could not find that forum. I tried really hard. Okay. Couldn't find it. But here we are. Okay. I learned that a bored young boy playing along a creek near Bend, Oregon, saw two little people who crossed the creek and stood looking at him. He said they were no more than 15 to 18 inches high and very dark complected. They wore skins as garments, and after a period of 10 to 15 seconds, walked back across the creek and into the forest. The boy showed their footprints to his parents, who had contracted to a logging company to clean up slash piles. The prints were obvious, and his parents were flabbergasted, but chose not to follow the little beings into the woods. He believes now that the little men weren't happy about the logging and destruction in the forest. And that's something else that comes up again in some Native American lore, and I believe some South American and from other places, are these, you know, little people that live in the forest, and, you know, maybe, you know, they carry around a bow and arrow, and they're dressed in skins and that kind of a thing.
There were supposed to be some, like, tribes or, like, little, like, small civilizations of smaller, kind of like human beings, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that were supposed to, and didn't, like, I feel like it was, like, a few years ago, some archaeologists or something found, like, I don't know if they were still living, but were recently, like, a very small in stature tribe of people living in, like, I think it was like North Africa or something like that, or in Central Africa. Like,
I found something about Indonesia, and we should definitely do another episode
like
on
like
that.
A whole, like,
but I
small...
believe that was fossilized remains.
Oh, okay. No, but these were like, I think they were like recent or something like that. But the notion is that, like, you know, they definitely did find some, like, fossilized remains and bones or something. I think it was bones of small in stature, like, Homo sapiens. So we know that, like, right? There was, like, a whole thing about it, like, a few years ago. You remember that? Okay. Well, yeah, they found, like basically evidence that there was this, like, kind of, like, splinter Homo sapien group that was just, like, a different size, that were smaller in size. And, you know, ostensibly that was, like, you know, there was others like that or whatever. But it's just interesting. Like, we think of, like, I mean, we know intellectually that human beings are like constantly changing size, right? You go to like Prague or something, you go on like Prague Castle, like all the doorways are like tiny, right? Like we've definitely like grown in size considerably.
And I think
from
that,
a few hundred years ago, that's not even that long ago, you know? So,
So another thing that keeps coming up again and again in these elf encounters is the idea that children can see them when adults can't, oftentimes.
Okay.
So there are a lot of encounters, and a lot of times they'll be completely friendly encounters. The children will be outside playing somewhere in the woods or in the beach, and there'll be like a little elf child or something that plays with them. So this person writes, I don't know if what I saw was a little person, but when I was younger, around 7 or 8, these little shadows or elves, maybe the size of a pinky, would come out in my room. I can't remember the feelings I had. I wouldn't go to bed with the lights out, and I insisted that my parents stay with me in my room until I fell asleep. I think they thought I was crazy or something, but I know what I saw. Most of the time, they walked on my window. But then when I turned the other direction, they would jump in front of me as if they wanted me to see them. I don't think I was all that scared, but I can still remember clearly what they looked like. Over a period of time, they disappeared. I think it lasted a year. Also, I remember that when I wanted them to go away, I would ask them to leave. If they didn't, then I would try to smack them with my hand, but they would disappear before I could. I don't recall them talking. It was strange, but I know it happened.
Wow, that's really interesting.
So this other one. Last year when my daughter and friends were four-wheeling in the woods in Washington State, again, Pacific Northwest, they were stuck and having problems getting out. When working at getting out, an elf-like person came out and looked at them. The elf had a bow and arrow, pointed hat, and pointed ears. Six people saw it.
Six people specifically. Well, if six people see something, you know that, like, statistically.
Okay. And it was armed. So this next one, it comes from South Africa. 1986 in Durban, South Africa, at the Mangrove Swamps Nature Reserve at approximately 6 p.m. On this day, a man named Paul and five friends set off on a hike off the main trail in the swamp. And he said, we walked for about 10 minutes when the swamp gave way to a clearing with rock formations similar to that of a small natural amphitheater. There were illuminated firelights all around this amphitheater. Directly in front of me was a small person who was just over 3 feet in height. He looked directly at me and pointed at me in surprise. So at this point, the entire group of friends had caught up to him. And he said, we looked around and witnessed little people sitting on the illuminated rock formations and others who were interacting with each other. The light and forms we saw were of an ethereal light, clearly less dense than the light we are familiar with. I estimated there to be between 20 to 30 of these little people. We were shocked and frightened by this phenomenon we experienced. So this kind of aligns with your story about the lights kind of being emitted. There's something about light with these beings. Okay. So he said the experience lasted only about 10 seconds, but seemed to play out as if in slow motion. We turned and ran as fast as we could toward our vehicle, he says. On arriving, we tried to make sense of what we witnessed. We returned to the spot and saw nothing but bush. No lights, no little people, no rock formation, just bush. So in other words, he tried to go back to the site and the entire thing, not just the beings, but the amphitheater and all of that.
The whole place.
The whole environment had shifted.
Okay. Cool.
And those are my elf stories.
Nice, nice. Yeah, there's definitely
no toy making.
Yeah, no. I don't even know what. I mean, I feel like that's a whole different other tangent of elves. Like, we didn't even really talk about that. But Well, cool. So what do you think is going on with these elves? What's up with
elves? You know, like you were just saying, I definitely feel like there are some areas in the wilderness and in, you know, out in nature and different places that seem to have an otherworldly feel to them, where you feel like there's something else present. And who's to say there isn't? I don't know if I think they live in rocks and have little cool houses, but I really hope so. I really hope so, and I want to see the decor.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean,
what do you think?
Well, I think there's a lot going on here, right? Like, it's definitely like, you know, I don't know. I feel like it's one of those categories, right, of phenomena. Even I wouldn't even say it's like entities, but just like a phenomena that's like somehow been cobbled together through name and through association, you know, over a very long period of time, right? Yet there does seem to be something about this word elf that sort mm-hmm. of follows, that tracks, right? Like, mm-hmm. and just not just, you know, setting aside the sort of modern, you know, elf from some of the modern fantasies, right? Like, you know, what was the big one? Like the Lord of the Rings stuff, you know, where, you know, they like obviously reemerged back into popular culture and sort of the collective consciousness. So it's hard to like separate that image of what an elf is from, you know, some of these stories and, you know, what the term used to mean. But I think there's something to it. And I think there's like a few things going on here, right? Like, you know, this original idea of like the demigod, right? Like of some type of being that has, that moves through, you know, dimensions or through a reality or, you know, through the physical and non-physical world and has sort of a power over it, right? An intelligence higher than ours or powers greater than ours in some way, right? Like we recognize that as something elf-like, right? Like that's some type of being, whether that's like this from, you know, stepped out of a UFO from another dimension or like living in a tree somewhere, like there's something about that that hangs together, right? And like,
right.
This idea of beings of light, right? Like, so, you know, the light elves of Norse mythology, you know, and then, you know, these some of these experiences that people have, like, you know, notwithstanding the Terrence McKenna, right? Like, example, right? Like, this guy who's, like, seeing these beings that are, like, made of light and they're trying to, like, sort of hide their true identity with, like, masks of their friends. Like, now, are these things, like, oh, that's an elf, and then this other thing that, you know, somebody else saw. Like, I don't know about that, but I think there's something about that word and that idea that threads these phenomena together, right? Mm-hmm. In a very real way.
And you kind of wonder also if, like, it's just kind of a linguistic thing. You know,
yes.
It's just semantics. Like,
right.
Gnome, absolutely. Angel, elf, sprite, fairy.
Right. Yeah, like in those studies, the Strassman studies and the subsequent ones as well, you know, people, it was only a small, most people would say being or guide in these experiences, but there was still this like 10 or 16% that, you know, used the word, that reached for the word elf. And, you know, it's kind of like we were talking about earlier, like the visionary experiences of an age, right, tend to be dressed in the sort of imagery of the age, right? Like the spiritual imagery of the age, right? And so the spiritual imagery of this age is like, there's a lot happening there, right? Like, but science fiction is definitely one of them, and fantasy is definitely one of them. And so, you know, some people see where someone 200 years ago might've seen an elf, someone might see like an alien now, right? Or an angel or whatever. And so I think that there is something being clothed upon some of this phenomena here. And some of it might be just like tricks of people's minds. Some of it might be stories, you know, people like to tell stories. It just like, it scratches some sort of itch for us. And some of them might be like real, like, you know, spiritual phenomenon, you know, or hallucinations, you know, but there's still something in it that gets to us. And it's this idea that there is this other world beyond us that is populated, right? And some of these and populated by beings, and some of them are ambivalent to us, some of them want to help us, some, you know, like, we just don't want to make them mad. Like, there's all these different relationships that you can have. And I think that, you know, this is one of those categories of, you know, creatures that falls into that, you know, into that category. So do elves exist?
Like, yeah, that's the question, Seth. Do they?
I'm going to say yes.
You're going to say yes.
Like, do they live in rocks and stuff like that? Like, I don't know. But like,
I might come down. Yeah, I might come down more on the side of like, there's something that can appear different ways.
Yeah. I think that the concept of elf is sound, right? Like, I don't think that there's like the Lord of the Rings conception where these like hyper beautiful, like running around with like shooting bows and arrows and stuff like that. I think that's interesting that one of your stories had the bow and arrow, but
it was like, a little guy, but yeah.
Some of these could
like
be like
the sexy elves.
Yeah. Or it's like some tribe.
But actually,
there were people or something.
Supposedly, they, you know, they can kind of be seductive.
Oh, really?
According to some lore, yeah. I didn't go into that.
Well, there is something definitely, we never really got into it, but there's something definitely sexy about elves, right? Like, there's a sexiness.
Depends what kind.
I guess, but I don't know. And like the movies and stuff. I don't like Shakespeare and stuff. I guess more fairies are also kind of sexual.
Midsummer Night's Dream kind of elves, Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So, all right. Well, I feel like we got into it here. How do you feel about
pretty good, we did elves.
I feel like we did the like broadest spectrum of elves. Like, you know, we didn't really get into some of the sort of fantasy elves as much, but like, I feel like we covered the mythological, the psychedelic, the
right. So if anyone out there listening has seen an elf, we want to hear about it. Or if you have any other stories, please send it to us, shadowlandpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Instagram.
Yep.
Please rate and review us. 5 stars, we would love. But rate us, please. And anything else you want to add? Oh, yeah, shadowlandpodcast.com. Check out our site because we add more content.
Yep.
For each episode.
Yep. All right, cool. Well, I feel like we did it.
We did it.
Okay, cool. So until next time.
All right. Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.
Shadowland Podcast is produced by Seth Javlin and Christina Callery. Edited by Tim Kelly. Theme music by Tim Lincoln.
Thanks, Tim.